Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease.
Welcome to another episode of Energy in Action. Today, we have Dr. Fran Kendall joining us. She has been on the podcast before and taught us so much and enlightened us about the book that she wrote. And she is here again today. As a reminder, she is with the Clinical Biochemical Genetics. She has founded VMP Genetics, and she's also an adjunct assistant professor at the University of Georgia. Welcome, Dr. Kendall.
Thank you, Marcy. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Good health and happiness is all we ask for, right?
That's exactly it.
So today we are tackling a new topic on the podcast with medical marijuana. So I really appreciate all of what you're going to teach us and your insight. And I do think you are the best woman for the job. So before we get started, I do want to say that Energy in Action with Mito Action would like to start this podcast with a very important disclaimer that Dr. Kendall and VMP Genetics have no financial interest in any laboratory. Any of the following information is not meant to be a recommendation or substitute for professional advice and service rendered by qualified doctors, lawyers, allied medical personnel, and other professional services. The responsibility for any use of this information or for proper medical treatment or legal advice rests with you, the listener. So thank you, Dr. Kendall. I want to get started initially by saying that many of our listeners, you know, possibly may have a negative connotation about medical marijuana, about pot, but there are so many benefits to those suffering with medical ailments. So I think a great place to start would be how marijuana became an aid for medical issues.
Well, there's a lot of historical information available about the use of marijuana, and it dates back to the Chinese in 1500 BC, the Greeks, and even the Egyptians. It was brought to North America via Jamestown in the early 1600s. And it was listed in the big book of pharmacology in the US in 1854. So for many years, there has been information available that suggests there is medicinal value to marijuana in general. Things changed in the early 1900s. Apparently, there were a lot of workers who were using marijuana for the purpose of stress and anxiety. And the government decided to address those issues and started processes to criminalize it, ending in a couple of legislations. The first one was the Federal Marijuana Tax Act of 1937, and a significant tax was placed on marijuana that prevented its more widespread use. But it was finally criminalized in 1952. And from that time forward, there's been a negative connotation associated with marijuana. That's changed in the last 20 to 30 years as more and more people have come to understand some of the medicinal benefits. Back in 1996, California legalized medical marijuana. And in 2012, Colorado legalized both medical and recreational use of marijuana. Now, since that time, more and more states have moved towards legalization of marijuana. So currently, there are 24 states where cannabis is legal. Four states still have no state cannabis program, and cannabis remains banned in Wyoming, Kansas, Idaho, and South Carolina. Then in the other remaining states, there's a hodgepodge of laws and legalities around the use of cannabis. Now, keep in mind, the big problem that we face right now is that because of the criminalization of marijuana in the past, cannabis is still listed as a Schedule I substance. So a Schedule I substance means a chemical or drug that has no medicinal value and is highly addictive and linked to abuse. So that's the biggest problem we face. So it's still listed as a Schedule I drug across the country, and different states have been changing the legality, but it still creates problems because federally it's still considered a criminalized drug. Now, there is an act that's sitting in the House of Representatives currently. It's called Marijuana 123 Act, and it was submitted on January 23rd, 2023, so about a year ago. And it is, the focus of the act is to reschedule the classification of marijuana to a Schedule III drug, which means it has medical benefits, but does have some potential for abuse and misuse. But that would be considerable if we were able to change that. Unfortunately, this act is predicted to fail and not move forward through Congress. So I don't see that changing anytime soon. So I think for the immediate future, we're going to be faced with ongoing issues where it's still classified as a Schedule I drug, and different states will make different laws surrounding its use, but that's problematic for patients. So that's the general status in the country. Now, Georgia has a fairly restrictive medical cannabis law, and our law passed on April 16th, 2015, and it was called the HB1 law, or Haley's Hope Act. And it allowed for the possession of up to 20 ounces of cannabis oil with no more than 5% THC. And so that's fairly restrictive. It's just oil. It's not gummies. It's not any other form of it, like even vaping. So this initial law allowed for the use of medical cannabis in 8 conditions. And one of those conditions was mitochondrial disease. And so we were actually the first state in the union that specifically identified the use of medical marijuana in mitochondrial disease. And that is in large part due to one of the parents who was working to get the bill passed, and his child has mitochondrial disease and intractable seizures. So when you speak to him about it, he will laugh sometimes, saying that when the nurse who was reviewing the conditions saw mitochondrial disease, she wasn't really sure what it was, but was too embarrassed to ask, so she approved it. But regardless, that was one of the original disorders that were covered by the medical cannabis law here. Since that time, it's expanded to include a number of other disorders, ranging from cancer to MS, sickle cell disease, Parkinson's. And the law has also expanded now to include the distribution of the medical cannabis products that are legal here. So until last year, we didn't even have a mechanism to obtain what was legal here. So patients literally had to break federal law in order to obtain what was legal within the state. So that has changed, and that has been helpful to the local patients here, that if they do have a medical cannabis card, they can actually obtain the product within the state. So medical cannabis and cannabis in general has had a very long history, ranging several thousand years, but it has certainly proven to be beneficial for many patients. And I'm happy to go into more detail with that in a little bit.
That was wonderful. You articulated that so nicely. So let's get into exactly, if I'm listening and I have mitochondrial disease, what have some patients said that that medical marijuana has done, or I guess I should say, what has marijuana done for them as a health benefit? What have they seen happen?
Well, the first use in the mitochondrial community, in my personal experience, was for seizures. And so a number of children with intractable seizures sought medical cannabis for that purpose. And I've had a number of patients who would be on polypharmacy, meaning multiple anticonvulsants, and still with poor control, who obtained much improved control, if not stabilization of their seizure disorder on medical cannabis, with the added benefit that they could wean off of some of the anticonvulsants that they had previously been on. And so anybody who is familiar with anticonvulsants knows that there are a lot of side effects. And that's part of the problem with people staying on them and using certain anticonvulsants. Sometimes the side effects are almost worse than the seizures themselves. So that was probably the first benefit. Some of the other things we've seen over time has been a reduction in just anxiety and depression in patients with mitochondrial disease or other disorders, especially in children who fall on the spectrum or have considerable developmental issues and struggle with OCD, anxiety surrounding that problem. So a lot of people and parents will report that they're just calmer. Things just don't agitate them as much as they previously did. So that's been very helpful. Some kids also seem to have improved focusing and concentration. In the adult population, the added benefit has been primarily surrounding pain and pain management. So, of course, the way adults present is typically somewhat different than children who have more neurocognitive issues and seizures. Adults have a lot of muscle weakness and muscle pain issues. And the medical cannabis has proven to be helpful for many patients in regard to their pain management.
Well, it seems like that's very all-encompassing for mitochondrial patients. It's, as you said, pediatric and adult, it kind of can help where it hits the hardest for both populations.
That's correct.
Okay. This is great information. I think there's so much to unpack here. So if you're sitting in a state that it's not completely illegal, which you mentioned the four, how do you obtain a card, a medical card?
The process for obtaining a medical cannabis card, it varies from state to state, but generally it requires approval by a treating physician. So I can tell you here in the state of Georgia, there's certain paperwork that needs to be notarized by the patient, submitted to their treating physician, and then submitted to the Department of Public Health. And so they process the paperwork and determine whether the patient is eligible based on state law. Once it's approved, then the patient is issued a card that generally lasts 2 years and then can be used to purchase product. There is some processing fee for the card, and it varies from state to state. So in Georgia, it's $25, but I know in other states it's more expensive. The other thing here in the state of Georgia is that prior to the pandemic, we would have to submit twice annually forms and follow-up information on patients who had a card. And it was basically to inform the state that they were still utilizing the card, that there were no complications and no other issues surrounding it. During the pandemic and subsequent, we haven't had to do that. I'm not sure why, but I think it's because most of the people in the medical cannabis program in the Department of Public Health were pulled to deal with the pandemic. And so our medical cannabis program struggled a lot during the pandemic for those reasons. It was difficult to get cards processed. It could take months on end. But when it was functioning well, it would only take a couple of weeks. So I suspect that most states have similar programs, but it generally requires the approval of a treating physician. Part of the problem some people run into is finding a physician who's willing and able to be there, almost like a sponsor for the card, because they don't understand medical cannabis, its use and benefits, and they are apprehensive about putting their name on a document that allows its usage.
Is that frustrating with all of the history of how it can help with pain management that there's still such apprehension in the medical community?
Well, it's certainly frustrating for the patients, I'm sure.
Yeah. We have so few tools to help us.
Exactly. And my general thought process, especially for things like seizure management or considerable pain, the other options and alternative approaches are not very good, and they're fraught with problems. I would much rather see somebody use medical cannabis for pain management than an opiate. There's no risk of overdose with medical cannabis. We don't have receptors in the brainstem for cannabis, meaning you're not going to get or develop respiratory failure as you can with opiates. And that's what happens with opiate overdose. You shut down your respiratory center and people stop breathing.
I think that's a really important distinction.
It is. And there have been some studies that have shown that the more widely used medical cannabis is for pain management in particular, the less opiate overdoses you'll see.
I totally get that. I mean, I've been offered them for all of the pain that I encounter on a daily basis, and I won't go down that road, but I see how easy it could be.
When people are in chronic pain, living from moment to moment is often all you can do. You're just trying to mitigate the pain.
Right.
You're just hoping the next minute is a little bit better and you have some relief. So people will try anything.
Right.
Because they don't have any other options to gain a quality of life. The problem in mitochondrial patients in particular is that opiates not only can shut down your respiratory center, but it affects your GI tract. And so most mitochondrial patients I know have any number of dysmotility problems. The last thing you need is a GI tract that works even more poorly.
Totally. And in my family, it's the respiratory system that is so affected because of the weakened muscles in that region.
Right. And that's the last thing you want as well for people who have respiratory problems to begin with, is for your respiratory center to be compromised.
Exactly. So if more people could go in this route, mitochondrial disease or not, when it comes to pain, rare disease, chronic issues that affect you on a daily basis, this seems like a really safe option that's gotten a really bad rap.
I agree. And again, if you look back to the history of cannabis, again, in the early 1900s, it was widely used. And I suppose that the government became concerned about its misuse and widespread use. But rather than develop mechanisms to regulate it or inform people, they criminalized it. And so there was a movie that was produced in 1936 called Reefer Madness. And that movie, which I've never seen, supposedly scared the daylights out of people about the complications and side effects of cannabis. And so they went from that movie in 1936, and then in 1952 is when it was criminalized.
So there's a lot of products out on the shelves if you have a card and you have the ability to, you know, go and kind of get your hands on this stuff. How do you select what? If I'm a mitochondrial patient, I'm having chronic pain, you know, all over my body, what do I buy if I've never walked in there? Could be a really intimidating process.
You're right, it can be. Part of the problem for patients is the fact that physicians don't know anything about it, so they can't really inform you. So while they might be willing to sign off on a card, they're not going to be helpful in terms of what do you take and what do you use. So you're at the mercy of the store or the dispensary. Now, in some states like Georgia, because only one product is legal, which is the oil that has up to 5% THC, there's not a lot of question because you can't get anything else other than a hemp product. So remember, hemp products are CBD with less than 0.3% THC. And that's the stuff you can get everywhere anymore. You can get gas station, and you can go in and they sell it in there. But in terms of things that have higher amounts that are not considered hemp product, what's available is very much dependent on the state and the state law. But let's pick a state like California or Colorado, where it is legal both medicinally and recreationally, and you're going to be faced with lots of different products. Unfortunately, either you're going to have to depend on the salesperson to inform you appropriately, or you're going to have to educate yourself about different products. Now, there is a good organization out in Colorado called Realm of Caring, and they have a lot of information on their website about different cannabis strains, what they can do, and a lot of information just about medical cannabis or cannabis in general. They also reportedly have nurses who man a hotline that can answer questions. So some of these organizations would probably be very helpful for people in terms of getting some baseline knowledge. But short of that, it's going to be in part trial and error. Keep in mind, you have to be familiar at least with what percentage of THC are in some products and what it does. Back in the 70s, some of the cannabis that was out there had about 5, 6% THC. Today, if you purchase it illegally, it can have 30% or more THC. So that's a huge difference. Most people who use medical cannabis are using it for the purposes of a problem or an issue, such as pain. They're not looking to get high. They're just looking to not hurt. So you don't necessarily want something with 30% THC. You might not feel the pain, but you might not feel anything else either. You want to find something that's...
Where you can function without pain.
Exactly. So again, it could be a little bit of a trial and error in terms of product, but if you have a general sense of you probably want something between 5% and not 30%, that gives you some range to start to deal with.
That's good info.
So again, it is challenging and the onus does fall on the patient. Now, I know more about medical cannabis and cannabis than a lot of providers, but I still can't tell you that I know every single solitary product that's out there and who's going to benefit from what, because there's too many of them. And so as a result, it does fall to the patient to sort it out to some degree for themselves. Some states will have foundations that help the patients navigate that. So Realm of Caring is a Colorado-based information foundation. But in Georgia, for example, we have a foundation called Georgia's Hope. And most people affiliated with that foundation are parents or others who have been instrumental in passing the law. So they have a lot of information and understanding about the process. So there are resources like that out there. But again, you're dealing with a patient population who struggles on a day-to-day basis that are now faced with yet another obstacle in terms of they have to commandeer it as opposed to somebody helping them navigate it.
Well, think about it. I mean, if I go to my pharmacy to get a prescription when I have a sinus infection, I'm told exactly how many pills to take, what right. milligrams they're at, and you know how many days to take them. You're not given any of that information. So it is really the ball's in your court and it's a ball that you're possibly not familiar with at all. Now, where some states it's legal for recreational use as well, why would it still be important for someone to get the medical marijuana card?
Well, that's a very good question. And I've wondered that myself, to be honest with you. And I've read a little bit that suggests that the cost through a medical cannabis card could be less. So I can't speak to it directly because, again, I reside in a state where we don't have recreational drugs that are legal or marijuana that's legal.
Every state is going to be a little different on this, but mainly the tax could be more expensive throughout the year than what the card costs.
Correct.
Yeah. So if you're just buying at a recreational level, you're going to be taxed higher than if you had the card.
Probably. Yes. And other than that, I'm not sure that there's much difference, but there could be. And it was just one of those areas of understanding that I just have limited information. It would be interesting for any patients in a state where both are legal if they could provide feedback about how it's beneficial to them.
Sure. I wonder if organizations like Realm of Caring would have more information about that. Now, if you're listening right now and there's a listener struggling to find an organization in their own state, do you think they could call one of these other organizations that you've mentioned, even if you're not in Colorado or Georgia?
Yes.
Okay. They might not have 100% information for your exact, you know, location, but I'm guessing they could still be helpful in a lot of ways.
I think they would be. Now, if you are in a state in which cannabis is legal in any aspect, and that's all the states except for the four I mentioned, most often the medical cannabis or cannabis program is under the Department of Public Health.
Okay.
So you could at least go on their website for your state, and they would give you information about the process if you're looking just to see what I would need to do for a card.
Got it. I feel like we've unpacked a lot here and there's a lot of information, but if you're out there and you're dealing with pain or you're dealing with seizures, this might be something that could really give you some improvement on a day-to-day basis. But I think this country is making it difficult because we have 50 states and we have 50 different policies. So, you know, when I connect with different people who have mitochondrial disease, I'm not talking to people even in my own state. So we're all going to kind of experience this differently.
Absolutely. And again, that is the major problem that we're dealing with. I think ultimately medical marijuana and certainly cannabis in general will be reclassified from a Schedule I drug, because there is more and more data that suggests and supports it being medically helpful. And we do have several products, including Epidiolex, which is an FDA-approved CBD/cannabis product. So that has been being used for refractory seizures and certain seizure types. So it's hard to continue to argue that it should be listed as a Schedule I drug when you're utilizing it for the management of seizures and have FDA approval for its use.
Well, let's hope so. It would make this process a lot easier for our community out there. So I really thank you so much for going through all of this with us. I think it's a very misunderstood topic, and there's, again, a lot of information, but I really hope that we've been able to inform our community. I think at Energy in Action, as the podcast host, I feel like it's my job to inform and create awareness for anything that could help our mito community on a daily basis. And I think this is a big topic. So I'm really appreciative that you and I could have this conversation. And hopefully we can do a follow-up episode as things continue to change so that we can help everyone navigate it.
I agree, and it's been my pleasure.
Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Kendall.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I'm so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.